Welcome everyone to the lecture of Professor Tim Waterman. Welcome to Warsaw. I'm really happy and honored and glad to have you here and also to be able to moderate the discussion after your lecture. Tim is going to talk to technicalities first and then I'll introduce our guest. So Tim is going to talk for 40 minutes approximately. Then I will maybe ask one or two opening questions and then you are all welcomed to join the discussion, so please be ready to participate. Tim Waterman is a professor at the Bartlett School of Architecture at the University of London in the UK. He's author of multiple books and editor of collected essays, and also he publishes and is a part of the Utopian Studies journal collective. So the most important books, the most prominent books are, for instance, Landscape and Agency, Critical Essays, Landscape Citizenships, which he co-edited with Jane Wolfe and Ed Wall, The Landscape of Utopia, Writings on Everyday Life, Taste, Democracy and Design, is his latest individual books, and there are four more individual books coming up. So you're going to have a lot to read if you like this lecture. And there is multiple other books and also collections of essays and articles concerning landscape studies. Tim is also the Inter-Program Collaboration Director at the Bartlett School of Architecture. He's chair of the Landscape Research Group. So his work on landscape is really incredibly vast and diversified in terms of genres of work. Today, we will focus, Tim will focus, and then we will focus with you, on the avuncular architectures, queer futurity, life economies. And I very warmly and cordially welcome you to this lecture, because I think it's going to trace a particular and novel way of experiencing and thinking with queer studies and landscape studies. So I'm really honored and happy, and let's welcome Tim Waterman in Warsaw. Thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you so much, Eva, and thank you all of you for coming. Thank you as well to Zachęta for hosting me. It's wonderful to be here. I've been very much enjoying Warsaw, and I must say I've been very well fed while I'm here. I would also like to thank Maria Zbyszek, Monica, and of course Eva for all the support. And I also need to thank my former student, Egle Paczkowskaite, who was the co-author of this essay when it was published in the first place. And one of the lovely things about the relationship that I had with Egle writing this piece is that I think it showed the way in which teaching is a kind of avuncular activity. You're not the parent of the student, you are helping them into the world in a way that is somewhat distanced. And that critical distance is really important to developing the mind and the critique that helps to change the world and its meanings. So the idea of the avuncular is really central to this talk. And this is simply to be an uncle or an auntie. And I think that there's a queer valence to that, but there's also a place for the auntie and the uncle in every society. And in fact, many societies call people of a certain age auntie or uncle. So you have a loose relation to people through the social collectives that you belong to in any culture. The other word that's important in the title here, actually there are a few. The second one is architectures, which I use in the plural. I think it's important not to see architecture as monolithic and singular, that there are many different ways of doing architecture and many different modes of architecture. Landscape, theatrical set design, buildings, I think even some forms of engineering are architectures. So that allows us to think about the way in which disciplines inform one another and are organized perhaps more along a platform rather than these hierarchical modes of knowledge, which we're so accustomed to. So there's an attempt to get away from patriarchal and hierarchical forms of knowledge there in the title as well. Queer futurity. This is about a relationship to the future, not just about predicting the future or thinking what the future might be, but futurity is an orientation to the future. It's a set of practices that relate us to the future. It's what we do in the present that recalls the past that brings us into the future. And then finally, life economies. Life economies are the economies which link us to the earth, to each other. So there's a very much more sort of more than human sense to life economies in the title here. I will fill that in a little bit more, and I had to give you some sparkle at the beginning, because a queer lecture just isn't queer enough without some sparkle. So this film you might recognize. This is Jacques Tati's famous film from 1958, Mon Oncle. And Jacques Tati is the director and also plays the character of Monsieur Hulot. And Monsieur Hulot is the uncle in the film, but also displays many forms of what it is to be avuncular, which I will speak of as the talk goes along. So there's a relationship to design that I want to speak about, and of making, of drawing, of enacting that are avuncular. And I also want to talk about those as practices of citizenship, that it's not just about what we do in the world to create forms, but it's actually the way in which we are citizens of places and help those places come into being more effectively. And I'm not talking about being citizens of nations. I'm talking about being citizens of substantive landscapes. So that's been very much a question in my work throughout. So I'll talk about spinster ecologies. I don't know in Polish whether the word has the same kind of tension. It does, Eva says. Like, it's perfectly all right to be a bachelor, but somehow to be a spinster is a really loaded term. It's almost accusatory. Like, what's wrong with you? Why are you a spinster? But I think when I'm looking at the 1950s, as I do in this talk, I think that there's something of that accusatory sense that is applied to the bachelor. When you reach a certain age and you're still a bachelor, it's a little queer. And maybe the question about whether you're queer becomes more to the fore. So in this case, Spinster Ecologies comes from a remarkable essay by the queer eco-critic Sarah Ansor. And the essay is called Spinster Ecologies, Rachel Carson, Sarah Orne Jewett, and Non-Reproductive Futurity. Right? So this, what does the future mean to you if you don't have babies, is basically what this article is about. Do you have an investment in the future if you don't make babies? And here's that accusatory sense which Sarah Ansor speaks about at the beginning of this essay. She talks about Rachel Carson and her book Silent Spring, and I'll just read you this quote. Attempting to discredit Rachel Carson's 1962 book Silent Spring, former Secretary of Agriculture Ezra Taft Benson, a suitably grand name, wrote to Dwight D. Eisenhower and asked, why a spinster with no children was so concerned about the future and so concerned about genetics. Benson's attack, its misogyny at best thinly veiled, makes legible one of the central challenges to developing a queer eco-critical practice, the status of futurity. Contemporary environmentalism, especially given the recent emphasis on sustainability, tends to be future-oriented, its rhetoric predicated on matters of inheritance and procreation alike. A popular environmentalist slogan asks, what will your children breathe? A proverb widely invoked across the environmental movement insists, we don't inherit the earth from our grandparents. We borrow it from our children. So Carson was a scientist. She was a great communicator. She wrote poetically about the sea and about the environment and helped people to understand. She wrote in a way that invited people into a completely different frame of knowledge. And I think this is something that's queer as well, that she invited people into thinking in an ecological way which was completely foreign, completely alien to the ways of thinking that were common to the world at the time. So she was a lesbian, although in her time, I don't think she would have identified as a lesbian. She had a passionate relationship with a married woman and exchanged passionate letters over the years with her. So her spinsterhood was partly related to her investment in science and her passion for the work that she was doing, but it was also because her affections were queer. I like to be very generous with the definition of the word queer. I think it allows people to belong to something other. So the more we allow that term to proliferate, the more we kind of chip away at that central edifice of hierarchy and patriarchy. So she writes about the sea around us in this book. She writes about the fact, and the message of the book is that when the pesticides that circulate in the environment begin to affect the bird life, there's a point when we wake up and there's no birds singing, it's a silent spring. I think that world is frighteningly much closer now than it was for Rachel Carson in the 1950s. But she used a mode of thinking which Rachel Carson calls intransitive. It's not direct. And a transitive relationship is one which is causal. And in fact, having children is a transitive relationship. I give birth to a child, that child is mine. But here, poison travels in ecologies. Poison moves in ways that intransitively, laterally, transversally affects the health of ecosystems. So it's indirect, and yet its results are felt directly. So intransitivity is an important quality for Sarah Ansor of what it means to have this queer sensibility, to think slightly outside and not giving birth to ideas in a way. It allows the use of the voice of the other. So here's Sarah Ansor speaking about Rachel Carson, that the spinster stands in a kind of slanted or oblique relationship to the linear vertical paradigms of transmission that govern familiar notions of futurity. And the figure of the spinster, she writes, practices an avuncular form of stewardship, tending the future without contributing directly to it. I really like the sense of stewardship here, that in a hierarchical mode of thought, stewardship is something you do to places or do at places, right? Like, I'm going to take care of this thing. But stewardship for the avuncular figure is something you do with. You take care of a landscape with it. You listen to it. It's about observing and understanding and not just impressing an idea upon that place. So that very much the act of observation, of listening and thinking clearly about the world is what Rachel Carson represents. And I love this image of her. She's just so wise and so warm. And I think maybe seeing that picture of Rachel Carson allows us to begin to reclaim the word spinster a little bit. If that's what a spinster is, what a lovely thing to be. Elspeth Probyn, who's a philosopher who works in Sydney, has an amazing book. Also, her interest is with the ocean, as it was with Rachel Carson. And she helps us to see Rachel Carson's work maybe through the lens of queer theory a little bit more queerly. And she uses this idea of the athwart, right? So this is a nautical term. If something is athwart the ship, it's moving across it. So something is across the bows. And Eve Kosofsky Sedgwick defines queer as meaning across. It's in some ways it's moving between, but in other ways it's a kind of obstruction. It comes from the Indo-European word root twerk, which also yields the German queer, which means transverse, and the Latin torquera, to twist, so to torque. So there's a twisting, a bending, and a thwartness that comes with queerness. And to work athwart is for Sedgwick to be within the spheres of continuing movement, continuing moment, movement, and motive, recurring, recurrent eddying, and troublant. So this reflects perhaps what Donna Haraway talks about when she says what is needed for our times is to stay with the trouble, that we need to make good trouble, and queers have always made good trouble, and that we also need to recognize the troubling times that we exist in and stick with it, and stick with it so that we don't lose the good things that we have. So there's a sense here that queerness is possible to save us, of saving us in a certain way. Okay, Harlow. This is a little bit of a jump, but I want to talk about a new town just outside of London and design in the 1950s that was happening at around the same time that Jacques Tati was making his films about Monsieur Hulot and Mon Oncle. So Harlow was a new town, and it was the kind of socialist dream of countryside but city living at the same time. All the benefits of the city, but the fresh air of the countryside were available in Harlow. I think it's important to realize that in Britain, these modernist forms are seen as terrible places to live. They, you know, when you come to Warsaw, you see this modernism and everybody lives there and it's fine. But in England, it's stigmatized. But here, what we're looking at is when it was fresh and families were just moving into it. And Harlow was also known as Pram Town. So the perambulators, the baby carriages. So this is the baby boom. And these were families that were moving out of East London into the countryside, and actually weirdly kind of severing their ties with the communities that they'd lived in to become modern nuclear families in this particular place. So they're actually moving away from all the aunties and uncles and moving into a place that's really focused on the nuclear family. This is a little bit of a simplistic way of looking at Harlow, because the designers did understand that people would be bachelors and spinsters and living here and working here, and they would be young and not married. And so it's not as simplistic as that. But here you can see that when Harlow was first founded, it was very much a town for reproduction and procreation. Here in the book by Richard Hornsey, The Spiv and the Architect, a spiv is gosh, it's a hard term to translate. It's a slick young guy who's maybe a little bit of a talker, maybe a little bit of a gangster. And so that figure is around quite a bit in the post-war years. And he talks about the ways in which these were repositories for newlyweds to build their families, and that these domestic patterns were actually built into the architecture. So there was, this was a kind of anti-queer environment. That's what Hornsey is saying. Again, I don't quite agree with him, but the reality of it was largely this. And the design for Harlow was based around the kind of thinking and very much influenced by the Britain Can Make It exhibition, which happened at the Victoria and Albert Museum in 1946. And what I really love about this is that actually when I was working on this in the first place, it's so hard for me to stay sitting down. Okay, I'll do that. So what you can see here is actually when I was working on this was in the middle of the pandemic. So this sort of one-way system was what I was living at that particular point in time, and that you might move through a very specific path. I think there's more thinking I still need to do about that. But it also recalls, I think, IKEA shops. That you move through in a specific way, you're locked into a route, you are forced to look at everything along a certain route. So it anticipates that form of consumerism, but of course this is also very much projecting a kind of consumerist utopia as well. So there's an idea here that the design of the city and the design of the exhibition and the design of retail environments can really sort of help us determine what our futures might be. So this has to have been terribly exciting in 1946. Years and years of deprivation and rationing, and people are let into the Victoria and Albert Museum, and it's full of new clothes and products and books. It must have felt at that point particularly utopian. In a sort of heteronormative way, of course. And I think also, to come back to Harlow, there's a sense, particularly in the UK, that there's no history to these sort of places, that they're invented entirely from whole cloth, that they're entirely new sorts of places. But there's very much a sense in what's happening at Harlow that he's trying, the designer, Frederick Gibberd, is trying to reference places that worked really well. So the Market Square in Harlow, and I love this clock in the market space, is referencing the Palazzo della Ragione in Padua very much explicitly. There's an arcade, the enclosure of the space, the clock tower forming part of the space is very important to it. And you can see that there's, in the drawings that Frederick Gibberd was making of the space, there was very much a kind of quotation of that throughout. And architects of the time would have studied Palladio exhaustively. So those references, I think, would have been very clear. Another interesting thing about Harlow is that the city planning followed the old field boundaries and maintained trees. So it wasn't the kind of erasure that you find in many sort of modernist new towns. I wish I could recommend for you to visit it now, but really the plan has been completely lost. It's very hard to read the original plans from visiting Harlow now. So you really have to be a scholar of the site in order to understand it. So I'm going to make another jump here to the idea of the future, or the lack of one. And the Harlow, I think, is an example of what you might call a life drive in architecture. It's a drive towards making life better, a drive towards making babies, a drive towards a better future, and it's charged full of all that post-war optimism. No future here is where we're actually talking, perhaps, a little bit about the death drive. And Eva and I have been discussing a little bit that there's a developing area of queer death studies, which talks about what queer people in many ways have learned from pandemics in the past. So the experience of the AIDS pandemic was very fresh still, and is still very fresh when COVID came along. And Lee Edelman's book, No Future, is a really important work which talks about the ways in which queers, because they don't have children, in many ways don't have that transitive responsibility for the future. It doesn't matter. It's not our future. And so this sense is really allied with the idea of jouissance, which is coming to us from Lacan. And this is the idea of pleasure, but orgasmic pleasure, right? It's pleasure that's really very much contained in a sexual orgasmic moment, living for the moment. And actually, to speak of death, orgasm is sometimes called the little death. So he goes on. He says, and there's some powerful words in this book, and I think it's very moving. He's, fuck the social order and the child in whose name we're collectively terrorized. Fuck Annie. And don't start singing any songs from Annie, because they'll get stuck in your head. He goes on. This is not for us. We don't have a responsibility for that future. So we're going to party like it's 1999. There's a kind of apocalyptic sense to that. Of course, this is very different from the sense of the apocalypse that Donna Haraway is giving us, to say, stay with the trouble, stay with the apocalypse, stay with the moment. That we're not giving up. Okay, so I'm going to come back to, I promise this will all add up at the end. If it doesn't, ask me more questions. So I'm coming back to Mon Oncle, 1958. How many of you have seen this film? Oh, great. I love it when no hands go up, because that means you have the pleasure of looking forward to this film. It is an absolute delight, and it hasn't aged a bit. The humor is still incredibly fresh. And I think one of the reasons why it has some relevance, perhaps, with Prins Golem and their work in the next room, is that the humor of the body and the place of the body is very much present in this. So Jacques Tati, the director, plays Monsieur Hulot. And here he is gleefully on his bicycle with his nephew in the film. And he's a bumbling character. He's kind of the opposite of Charlie Chaplin. So Charlie Chaplin is kind of, you know, sloped back like that. Monsieur Hulot is very much up on the front of his feet. So it's a very different body language, and it plays out beautifully in the films. I think it's wonderful to watch Hulot next to Chaplin, to see how they use their bodies differently in the space. So there's a kind of queerness here, because Hulot is a single bachelor who has a responsibility for raising his nephew. But in real life, Jacques Tati didn't marry until he was 37. In the 1950s, that was suspect. It was a little strange if you didn't, if you took that long to get married. So I think that he probably had some of these kind of queer sensibilities. He certainly had the sensibility of the other. He was always at a critical distance from society. And what his films do beautifully is observe the world. The humor in Jacques Tati's films comes from just a kind of simple amplification of the way that people move in the world. He watches people, and in many cases, he had real people participate in the films, and he would ask them to be a little more themselves to the point that it becomes humorous. There's a wonderful criticism of the films that came from a 13-year-old in the Cahiers du Cinéma about the time that the film came out. And he says, the wonderful thing about a Jacques Tati film is you come out of the cinema and the film's still going on. So it's that observational quality of just watching the world and caring about it is really important. So this is the opening scene. It's in the traditional city, which of course is crumbling because this is the post-war city. But of course, Tati is very affectionate towards this city. And it takes place between two worlds. There's the new town that is beyond the traditional city center. And Hulot works across this boundary. In Tati's films, people often say, oh, he's a traditionalist. He loves the traditional city. There's no such judgment that's happening here. He's just looking. He's watching the way that people interact with the modern city and laughing at it. And he's watching the way that people interact with the traditional city and laughing at it. So all of this comes together beautifully in this film. So here's the old city. And the street sweeper in the film is just constantly sweeping things into a little pile, but he never finishes sweeping. Someone comes and talks to him, and he goes off to the cafe and has a coffee. The job never gets finished. So that's a kind of representation of the traditional city. And then here's the modern city, and this sort of outlandishly dressed woman is the spinster neighbor and this is on the left is one of the parents of his nephew, and so it's high modernism, and there's at one point in the film they try to get Monsieur Hulot together with the spinster character, and of course it doesn't work. They're both resolutely single, and probably unmarriageable. And this is the plan for the house in Mon Oncle, which I think you can see has this kind of modernist determination of where people are going to walk. Here, this space is for this, this space is for this, and you must move in this way. And much of the humor in the film comes from people having to walk around the spaces in a way that is dictated by the pathways, which becomes humorous. So if I come back to Frederick Gibberd, now this is the designer of Harlow, of the new town of Harlow. I found this wonderful image of him looking so incredibly avuncular that he really, I think, did have an investment in this place. He moved to Harlow. He created a garden on the outskirts of Harlow, which is celebrated and very well worth visiting to this day. And I think there's a sense here that what he's giving is a gift that is moving into motion that isn't really his anymore. He's created a place, and it's allowed to be its own thing, and he can just get back on the bus and drive away. His work is done. He hasn't fathered his designs into existence, but rather he's uncled them into existence. So I think there is a really direct parallel. Now, I don't want to say, of course, by any means that either Jacques Tati or Frederick Gibberd were what we would call gay now. But I think that there's something a little queer and a little bit occupying the place of the other in both of these people's work. So I should probably move a little quicker to get through the last little bit. But I want to talk about Life Insurgent. So this is throughout modernism, there's a sense of the idea of revolution, that we're going to erase and rebuild. But there was also another kind of parallel sensibility in the 20th century, which actually preceded what Rachel Carson was talking about in Silent Spring. There was a sense of ecological being and of the place of humans on the earth before that. And this is one of the progenitors of those ideas. So this is Élisée Reclus, an early geographer at the turn of the century. He wrote a six-volume set called L'Homme et la Terre, Humans and the Earth. And this is the frontispiece from his book. He was very well-traveled. He was an anarchist and participated in the Paris Commune, escaped the Paris Commune and survived, and went on to teach and write. And the frontispiece from the book says, L'homme et la nature prennent conscience d'elles-mêmes. Humans are nature becoming conscious of itself, which I think is a really beautiful thing to say, especially at the time. I think what we might do now is add that there are forms of consciousness and intelligence in the world, like the way that trees communicate, for example, that make this a little more complicated now. But what a beautiful statement to say, we are a consciousness emerging within nature. And I think there's a sense of stewardship that comes across in that. There's a sense of responsibility for that, which isn't, again, not about, you know, fathering or mothering something into existence, but being part of it. So Reclus, and the reason that he's important is that the ideas of Patrick Geddes, who was a Scottish planner, directly influenced what was happening in Harlow, and they also directly influenced a lot of the ideas of planning that were happening in France, that went directly into the films of Jacques Tati. Those are both some magnificent beards, I have to say. Geddes was actually, he met Reclus. It was a very difficult meeting. Then Geddes also described himself not as an anarchist in the sense that Reclus was, but as someone that understood that thinking through actually observing the way people govern themselves and move in space and organize themselves in space, the idea that anarchism is a theory of organization rather than chaos is really something that Patrick Geddes took to heart. So actually building cities that allow people to govern themselves rather than to be governed externally is incredibly important. And you have to be, you can't be fathering things into existence if you want the world to run itself well. And here's where a little bit of the landscape ideas come in here. Geddes created something called the Valley Section, and he talked about the ways in which people found their citizenships and their work and their dwelling and their belonging and their identity from the landscape niches that they occupied. So here you are all along the valley, and the different landscape types dictate who you are. So this is a simplistic vision, but I think a very powerful one that helps to kind of classify what topography and hydrology mean to human being and human becoming. And I do realize that there's a swastika lurking in the background of this diagram, but it's in the very best sense of the swastika being a kind of traditional symbol of return. So here you might think that it's more like the yin-yang, that it talks about a flow of ideas. And this is one of Patrick Getty's ideation diagrams, which talks about the way in which we need to think about the world all at once, that everything in the world needs to be thought about simultaneously if we're really going to understand. So it's acts, deeds, facts, thoughts, and dreams. And of course, these are dreams about the future, and everything's in motion, everything's in process. So here you have that idea of futurity as being something that is a process that we're moving towards. Okay, I'm not going to read this very long quote, but I do want to kind of scaffold here that together with this kind of queer eco-critical practice, that we might move away from the idea of revolution and more towards holding together the things that we value, to think about the way that life can rise up within the structures that we construct for building the world around us and building our human relations within the world, and that there is a kind of life economy of this acts, deeds, thoughts and dreams, which brings all of that together, and an all-at-onceness of thinking. And then Sarah Ensor, I think, also talks about the idea of enoughness, which is also really important, because the beautiful thing about nature is that there's so much excess. There's so much superfluous material. And actually, that's also part of what we need for life to be enough. A sense of sustainability as just giving up everything so that we go to bare life and then the planet can survive isn't a kind of natural drive. There is a superfluous overflowing that happens. Like, okay, and when the uncle visits, there's an overflowing of gifts. There's an overflowing of a different sort of love and of ideas and possibilities that's brought into the family in that way. So I'm striving for an idea of sustainability that is also about beauty and sharing and joy that we can build into the buildings that we make, we can build into the ways that we interact with landscapes, and we can build into the ways that we interact with each other and with other species. So there's very much a utopian drive here, which I think is quite queer. So in distinction to what Lee Edelman is talking about partying like it's 1999, that we have no responsibility to the future, Munoz says, actually, the future is not yet here, and the future is also queer. That the future is one that is full of diversity. The future is one that is healthy because of that diversity, and it's one that isn't sort of smashed into hierarchies and smashed into expectations of what humans are supposed to be, but rather allows humans to become what they need to be in their environments. So this is probably one of my favorite books. It's a magnificent piece of writing, Cruising Utopia. Such a positive and such a queer view of the world. I'd say really necessary reading. So I'm going to move extremely quickly through the last couple of slides because I'm 45 minutes in. But I just wanted to say that the work of Henri Lefebvre, which was very much in circulation at the time that Jacques Tati was making his films, also talked about jouissance, but not in the Lacanian orgasmic sense of jouissance. He was talking about jouissance as bonheur, as a good time, as plaisir, pleasure, which is very generalized. So a good meal gives you pleasure. Volupté, voluptuousness, which I think you can see in a landscape or in the human body, And there is a sexual sense there. So there is an idea that the sexuality and the freeing of sexuality is really important. And finally, I think also the French sense of the word joie, that joy is part of that too. So this vision of a kind of queer sustainable future has to come along with all of that jouissance. Łukasz Stanek says that this is really about a concrete realization of utopia. It's about bringing jouissance into the world, and it seeks to conceive of a new space which only can be based on an architectural project. That, I think, is really interesting, especially for those of you from outside of the architectures. It's useful to say that maybe architecture isn't just about making buildings, but architecture is about making lives and making the spaces that enable those lives. And that queer distance is necessary for the kind of observational sensibilities that are required to make great places. You can't go in fathering into existence a space that you think the world ought to be. You need to watch what the world wants to be and help it become that, and also help it to take form in various ways. So I think all of this gives us a great deal of food for thought about how we go about constructing the world of the future and how we go about dealing with some of the greatest challenges of our time: climate change, biodiversity loss, fascism, all of which are very much a part of our contemporary lives right now. But I think we can look back at the past and look at it lovingly and bring what we love from the past into the future. And that includes all of the jouissance, the good times, and that it is possible for us to project a world in which humans continue to survive and survive well and to flourish with one another. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tim, and thank you very much everyone who came to the lecture. I'm really grateful for the generous set of landscape of associations that you drew for us. I believe that many of us will be thinking about different aspects and dimensions of your talk at different times. You're more than welcome to ask questions or make comments to the lecture, so please get ready with that. And as my experience says, most often people need some time, the audience needs some time to get ready to ask questions. Please get ready, I'll talk to Tim for a moment and to you. Because I was thinking about this kinship that you talk about. So this weak kinship, I would call it, yes? Or because of the distance, because of the different purpose. So when we are auntie or uncle, we have a different purpose in the life of a child usually, but also of an adult person. It's not to make them survive, it's not to provide for them, to make their, we are not indispensable. We are disposable. There could be another uncle, there could be another aunt, right? While with mother and father, it's a little bit more complicated, although with queer practice and theory, we actually get to learn a lot of different variations. But until now, or until recently, we were thinking that an aunt or an uncle is somebody that isn't indispensable, and yet they are the people who can, while parents cannot, introduce the children to things that parents would never do it because it's too risky, because it's dangerous, because it wouldn't be responsible, etc., etc. As an aunt coming to somebody's household once a year, I am fully entitled, I think, to experiment with the kids, to show them, okay, this is what you could also do. You can climb the fence if you want to, and I'll be there, and I will not tell your mom. Basically, this I will not tell your mom is a super important element of what a good aunt can be. And in the movie that you were discussing so plainly, this uncle is precisely doing this gesture of holding the hand. It's really nice. I really like that you chose this frame, because So that adult, being an aunt or uncle, they are with the kid, but they are not, perhaps they are not indispensable, and yet they show some other parts of the world, more risky, more dangerous, more adventurous, more or less convenient or less conventional, that was the word I wanted to use. So I'm thinking that this attitude, and I was thinking about care, because as I work on a project which discusses the role and ways how the state apparatus is caring for us. So the police, if you ask the policemen what they are doing, they are caring for you. Even if they put you in out of a demonstration or do other things, it's in the name of care always. So there are forms of care that I'm very suspicious of. And I don't like, I disagree with a lot of feminist narrative, which currently prizes care like as if it was only innocent, only good and only safe. A lot of care is done in the name of dangerous ideas, is done to disempower someone rather than empower, no? So I think that if we think about the future of the world with queer authors, with Munoz, with Stanek, with other people, then with you, then we see a different version of care. We are a little bit suspicious of certain forms of care, which are too much, let's put it this way, which are too strong, I would also say. And we learn to appreciate something that I would call a weak care or weak affiliation or weak kinship, which steps down from this role of indispensability and risks the possibility that, yeah, there can be another auntie. I might not be the best auntie of, you know, this and that child, right? I might cease to be, but by the fact that I'm not their parent, I can do things that parents would never risk to. So anyways, I'm looking, hearing your lecture now and looking at the slides also, amazing collection, by the way. I'm very jealous, I can't do that so well. So I was thinking of this weakening of the ties of kinship and of caring. And also I was thinking of the weaknesses that we see just in the room next door of Prince Golam duet drawings and performance, how they capture the everyday, how they capture those very ordinary poses, activities, humans in the sketchy kind of form. And I was thinking also of a role of the rehearsal. Mm. We were talking about it before this lecture. The sketch used to be not the work of art. The artwork was supposed to be painting or sculpture. The sketches were just training, just essays. And in the 90s, maybe also a bit earlier, drawing became the noble artwork as well. But it took a while to recognize this importance. But this is also like a weak artwork, no? It's so back to you, and also please everyone feel free to ask comments, raise your hands please, and I'll catch you and get you the microphone. We will have to talk to the microphone because of the translation and recording, so when you want to ask your question, just raise your hand, I'll be there. But Tim, back to you, and thank you.
Yeah, maybe if I start with the drawings outside. The term in French for a preparatory drawing is the esquisse, and this is very much something in architecture where a sketch that leads to the final design is an esquisse, is a sketch. So it's practicing, it's rehearsing on your way. And this is very much part of design. It says, well, what if it's like this? What if it's like this? And I think actually many of the drawings outside are practicing different circumstances. They're just putting bodies together and seeing what happens with those bodies in these kind of, what if there's a little bit more of a sexual charge? What if this is really quite innocent and it's bodies just playing in a park? Those kinds of ideas are in there. And I think the way that parents teach their children to rehearse the world is a very kind of specific way, and it's very much related to reproduction. You know, the kinds of toys that parents might buy their children are about learning to cook or to drive or to... whereas an uncle or an aunt might bring in completely different kinds of influences, and they're also not really trying to be good parents. They're just themselves. They're not, you know, working so hard. So actually, Eve Kosofsky-Sedgwick says that the figure of the aunt or the uncle introduces queerness into the family. And again, using a very generous sense of queerness, this could be, you know, maybe Uncle Bob drives a motorcycle, right? And maybe Uncle Bob might let you ride on the motorcycle with them, but don't tell your parents. So there's that kind of riskiness to the associations, but it's not that risky because there is still a sense of responsibility that happens there. But I think also that kind of weak association is something that scales up to the size of the community. And it's something that's disappeared out of a lot of Western societies, the idea that in public life, we have a duty of care to one another. And a duty of care is different than, you know, sort of forms of care which are might be oppressive. Mm-hmm. A duty of care just means an obligation to one another. I need to recognize your existence as a human, give you space on the sidewalk. I need to recognize that you might have different needs. It just means watching the world around.
Or actually an ability to respond to somebody else's presence, right? Within the feminist, the materialist feminism, in the recent years, that notion of responsibility with a myślnik, with a, and hyphen, sorry, I just forgot the word. So this responsibility is precisely the ability to respond to other people's presence, and it's not obsessive, it's not toxic. I mean, I was thinking many years about the difference between certain vectors within feminist and queer theory. Some parts of queer theory seem to move directly against some parts of feminist theory in the context of care and responsibility. So the risky guys like Lee Edelman, whose passage you were quoting, which I'm very happy to see it in Zachęta National Gallery. It's always refreshing to see some other discourse than the official art theory discourse hosted in the room. So there are actually real dangers of the uncles, especially, but also some aunties can be particularly vicious. No, so obviously when we prize this riskiness of the auntie or uncle's presence, we do not forget about oppressiveness and violence that sometimes comes with it. So this is our secret. You know, when it concerns riding a motorcycle, it's fine. But when it concerns unwanted or unsolicited sexual activity, for instance, then it becomes dangerous, right? For me, the best option was always to move somehow on the intersection of queer and feminist theory, remembering the necessity of riskiness, of taking risks, of being able to risk one's existence, one's good humor, one's comfort, whatever risk. So this importance of risk for me was always a necessity. I never wanted to go far away from it. However, there are certain risks we might not want to confront, or we might not want the children whose aunts or uncles we are to confront, right? So, this is this responsibility or this weak kinship, I think, suggests the knowledge of this. It's like kinship with responsibility.
The responsibility that's on top of that, that's on top of the notion of care, is a responsibility to be decent, which is perhaps what's missing from a lot of the discourse about care, is that, yes, it's important to be caring, but we also need to be decent to one another. And I know that sounds like such a simple, straightforward thing, but the idea that we should be decent to one another, that we should be decent to other species,
to the planet, even
to the planet, right. Yeah. That the act of caring, the act of uncling, the act of auntieing, you know, all of this is accompanied by an obligation to be both caring and decent.
But I don't mind you speaking about ordinary things and ordinary activities. I think that this is very much what Prince Galán also introduced to the gallery with their exhibition, is precisely those very ordinary, as we mentioned, shapes and compositions, let's say, of humans in their quite natural everyday habitat. But also I was thinking about the everyday as something that was negated by a lot of anti-normative queer theory, let's say. So I was thinking about that tension when you were speaking, the tension between the desired inclusiveness of queer communities, queer studies, queer theory, and queer anything. So the inclusivity on the one hand and diversity, and then on the other hand, prizing certain models against the others. So if we go very far direction no future, we start to be incredibly oppressive, I think, towards the mothers, the you know, the, even the, some uncles and aunts who are not as risky as as certain versions of anti-normativity would teach us. And yet, on the other hand, obviously, in order to be capable to resist oppression, to build criticality and critical theory, the need for something edgy and avant-garde and uncommon is huge. In especially in European culture. However, with some parts of queer studies, with Kosofsky Sedgwick, with Jack Halberstam to some extent, with other authors, we come across queer theory which tries to embrace what passes as ordinary, as everyday, as non-exceptional. And I like this twist within queer theory. Also, Anne-Marie Jagosi has this essay from 2015 where she explicitly speaks of the trouble with anti-normal and anti-normativity. And it's a very interesting essay. I highly recommend it because it puts us in front of this dilemma. How far can we go with extravaganza, let's say, with queer anti-normativity? To what extent our being anti-normative starts to is liberating, and from when it becomes another obsession, another scoutism, another desire for uniform. This time it's going to be a punky, you know, drug dealing uniform, but still it's going to be a uniform, no? And there is going to be a certain unity within anti-normals, let's say, that is going to start to be exclusive versus those who are more normalized, let's say. So this is one thing. And another thing is about queerness being so changeable. So Perel Brielmeier, my former colleague from Berlin ICI Institute, she recently published a text in Queer in a Critical Inquiry journal where she speaks about rigidity of desire. And this is also an essay I highly recommend. The essay starts in a very unconventional way for academic essay because it starts with the words, what turns you on? I think a very nice opening for again. So if you want to do it, I'm sorry, somebody else already did it. But anyway, so what turns you on? And then she muses about this diversity of desires and how queer people are so queer, la la. And then she says, but in the end, most people are capable of answering that question. What turns you on? So most people can say like this, that, and not this, that. So what it means? It means that desire, however flamboyant and errant and changeable it might be, it still fixates, to speak psychoanalytically, sorry to the translators for that. So the desire fixates on certain things, right? And what you are talking about is, I think, very much about that, about how we want our cities and our spaces to be queer, but not exclusive, and also not too safe or not too rigidly constraining our movement, right?
The question of what turns you on, I think is a really, really important one, because it actually talks about what's superfluous and what's outside of the ordinary. Because if ordinary everyday life, you know, if going to the supermarket turned you on, you would be constantly, you know, it would be a problem.
Are. I think some people are.
It might be a problem. But it also points to the fact that the everyday is not just about the boring. That the everyday is really highly textured. And the texture of everyday life includes going out at the weekend and partying like it's 1999. It includes festivals. It includes rituals and celebrations. All of those are part of the texture of everyday life. And of course, what turns you on is when someone maybe makes a little extra effort to be beautiful or sexy and come into the room in a certain way. And that is actually a natural process. It's a natural process of the superfluous, which is built into nature. So alongside adaptation, there's exaptation. So exaptation is, for example, where a bird has feathers, and those feathers allow it to keep the water off of its back and to fly, to give it lift in the air. But those feathers also might be iridescent, or they might, you know, create a crest, and other birds might go, that's pretty sexy. So it's actually about the ways in which the superfluous is built into the structure of the everyday, which again, really, I think comes back to my point about if we are going to talk about a sustainable future, it cannot be bare life. Mm-hmm. It has to be a future that includes all of these possibilities. What we need to do, though, is to reevaluate what our priorities are. Because actually, I think that most of the things that make us truly happy or that turn us on are actually pretty simple. You know, not everybody needs a BMW and a Rolex to get turned on. Actually, it might just be a glass of wine and some music and... Mm-hmm.
You're approaching a topic of another book that I highly recommend, which is, I think the title is Long Term, and it's an edited volume, co-edited by Heather Love, I think. And in this volume, many queer theory authors are reflecting upon long-term relationships. So also something very, when I first came across that book, I was very shocked that any queer studies scholar would invest in such a book, because I had this image still some years ago of queer theory and queer people more specifically being those people who don't engage for long-term relationships. And then suddenly there is this whole book of essays when people discuss and reflect upon how to stay in long-term relationships and being queer. And I think this is also an interesting part of what you're talking about and what our artistic duo, Prince Galam, are trying to emphasize is precisely that certain things and certain sustainability requires some long-term investment. And that this long-term investment does not have to be bare life. So it does not have to be deprived of any pleasure, desire, jouissance, as you say. But it can be full of it. However, it might resemble very much to, for instance, what other people like. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to be also super exceptional, and yet still it's going to give us pleasure, right? So I'm really happy and grateful that both you spoke about it and that the artists have worked about it, because I think we need to learn to be together, and togetherness is also achieved by resigning from some exceptionality. Mm-hmm. We can be different, yes. But certain modes of exceptionality just simply go too far and become exclusive, I think. So I believe that what you were talking about and this kind of like very normal scenery of the movie especially, that was really joyful. Mm.
I hope you're all going to go and watch the Monocle now. I guarantee you will be just charmed beyond belief. Does anyone have questions for me?
Or comments?
Or comments. I'm not one who is averse to comments.
So first there was the person downstairs and then okay.
So what I'm thinking right now is that architecture is always like late. I mean like when you do some urban planning and everything like started to be built and people start to live in, like I'm thinking about this city in England, close to London. So that afterwards you said that right now it's totally different. It had changed, that the main principles were like the starting point, and then everything, new layers started to reorganize this place of living. And I'm thinking if, actually I'm an architect, so basically in the field of this, Is it going to be always like this, that what we should do now is appearing 10 years later, and this delay is kind of for me frustrating. And what do you think about this delay, actually, that right now you're like people are thinking about the cities from 50s, from 70s, from 10 years ago, but actually what I'm seeing right now is that even nowadays, architecture or urban planning is not fresh. It's like from 5 or 10 years ago, but it's mm-hmm. appearing right now. And this delay is kind of, and another question: if you can say like place you think that is right now is like transforming in a very good way one place, or you think it's actually it's organic and it's not going, it's never going to be like big. Big master plan, it is going to be like a lot of small revolutions and everything will be evolving, not building from the scratch.
The problem of architecture always being 10 years out of date is something that I find enormously frustrating as well. You know, in London, you still have Norman Foster defending designing airports, and, you know, actually, we need to move beyond that. Yeah. And the fact that the designs don't feel fresh anymore either. I think what's going to happen in the future of architecture is really interesting, because it is going to blow away a lot of the ways in which we've operated in the past. I think, first of all, one of the themes that's becoming much more prevalent in architecture now is the need for adaptive reuse and material reuse. So knocking things down and building new buildings all the time and everywhere is not a sustainable practice, and we need to be making better use of what we already have. For me, what's really exciting is that means that we need to start looking much harder at actually existing places and how people are using them and how they could be modified to be made better. And I think there are a number of fabulous examples in contemporary architecture where people are transforming buildings and cities and landscapes in really meaningful ways without creating some avant-garde work, which is actually not really avant-garde anymore. So I feel very optimistic, actually, that the future that architecture holds is a very attractive one. There's a couple of other things I think that are important. One is that the idea of the architect as the master of everything has to go away, that we have to begin to act with humility and to listen to other professions, and to listen to communities, and to listen to cities and buildings and landscapes themselves much more effectively than what we've done. And that is both more difficult and way more interesting than the way that architecture currently operates. And there was one more thing that I was going to say, but I think I've forgotten it. But I really do feel like we are moving out of that terrible conundrum in which the avant-garde is always 10 years too late. And we will move into something which is actually much more at peace and at home with living with the past and at making transformations that are much more gradual and processual. Some people call it incrementalism, a mode of architecture which is incrementalism, that cities need to move forward more slowly. The other thing that I was going to say about that is that incremental building and adaptive reuse and material reuse requires communities to come together and actually touch the architecture themselves. And it also means there's much less of a place for the big developer. So you have a lot less of the big money coming in and transforming places in huge ways, which then become alien to the people that actually live there. And you actually then begin to have architects and landscape architects and urban designers who might move into communities and say, what do you have here? How can we make it better? And how do we maybe find the money here to do it instead of asking the assholes? So that's, I think there's a lot of hope for architecture in the future.
Microphone, please.
So could you say point one district which for you, like as you observe nowadays, is kind of really in a good development state in terms we are talking right now about? Like where is right now, what should I Google and like have a look? What is good right now?
I can talk about a design that I just wrote about. I wrote an article about a place called Bridgefoot Street Park, which is in Dublin. And the landscape architect who worked on the park, the park is on his route between home and work. So he passes through it all the time. And the park was constructed of elements that were, like if the city was digging up a sidewalk, he would go, and he'd be like, "Oh, I'll have those pieces." And so it was very much pieced together from the neighborhood. And there's bits of old concrete and curb stones, and the way that the site is cared for isn't a top-down design. The maintenance teams that come in and look after it, that care for the park, are told to just disturb the soil because that will encourage seeds. So they only clear out the plants which are actually hazardous, you know, so like stinging nettles and brambles and things like that are removed, but the rest of the park is just allowed to kind of... And what's interesting about it too is that it's a young community that's moving in, so it's a little bit like Harlow. It's young couples, but then also a lot of queer couples moving into that neighborhood, and they're okay with that aesthetic, whereas, you know, maybe a richer neighborhood wouldn't like to have weeds and old curbstones in their neighborhoods. So it shows the ways in which actually taste making needs to operate alongside architecture. And this is actually what the utopian theorist Ernst Bloch talks about as the education of desire. So it's actually we can help our desires to become better, and that education of desire in ecological design and design for biodiversity has actually created the possibility that you might make a scruffy park in a city and people would find it beautiful because of its scruffiness and the fact that there are bees and butterflies and such buzzing around and that it's clearly a healthy place. So that's Dermot Foley, landscape architect, is who's done that. And I think it's just beautiful, beautiful design.
Thank you. I regret that I missed the first half, so I may be asking a question you already addressed.
That's all right.
But you spoke about decency, mm-hmm. and caring and responsibility. I realize they're all quite different, but I wonder, in this socio-architectural concept, who defines those things? You spoke about breaking away from them, about the uncling and aunting, et cetera, about exposing to things that parents, I guess, aren't exposing the child to, or the person who's in this society that's redesigned. So who defines those things that are decent and caring and versus the things that are not caring and not decent and not? So where is that drawn, that line?
In one sense, there's actually an evolutionary sensibility that helps us to define what decency is, because Élisée Reclus and then also Peter Kropotkin, another contemporary anarchist, wrote about the idea of mutual aid in evolution, and that it's not the survival of the fittest individual that drives society forward or that drives species forwards. It's the fittest species. It's the fitness of a species to work within itself and to work with other species that helps evolution move forward. And it's the same with cultural evolution. So many of the things that we learn, which we would consider common decency, are actually evolutionary tactics for helping humans become better humans. And I love it that there's, many years ago, I think early 90s, there was a book by Robert Fulghum called Everything I Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. And it was, you know, it's just look both ways before crossing the street, look after each other, don't forget to share, you know, all these things which are really straightforward and what Aristotle would have called the little virtues. The little virtues are absolutely key to manners and our ability to get along with one another. And I think actually that a lot of sustainability and the ability to move towards a better future and to have a better planet and to become better humans comes down to the simple question of manners, of actually being good and thoughtful to one another and to other species and to the spaces around us. I know that sounds like the most bourgeois thing you've ever heard anybody say in a room,
Yeah, but let's not exclude bourgeoisie completely. They have a role in they history. Have they have to fail gracefully, no? So you're welcome.
The difficult thing when talking about manners is that there are so many patriarchal assumptions that are, you know, like, okay, the man has to open the door for the woman. You know, that's not the kind of manners that I'm talking about. I'm talking about treating other humans as humans. Mm-hmm. And giving other humans space in the world, and the stuff about those kinds of manners are not what I'm taking. But when we speak about decency, I think actually manners and taste, and it's very much a part of my work, is to talk about ways in which taste can be made positively, and the way that taste kind of, and shame even, help to keep us kind of in line, in a way, where the desire isn't an outrageous desire, a Trumpian desire.
I was thinking of what feminists and queer studies scholars are doing actually together quite a lot, is this dismantlement of the prioritization and hegemony of the traditional version of the subject. So who gets to be treated as a good human? For many decades, for many actually millennia, it was a very masculine, strong, hegemonic, racialized, I mean, in the contemporary cultures, usually a white man with privilege would be the human, and then whatever else was within humanity was less human or non-human at all. And then, I mean, at least in the radical version. So I think what you talk about when you say politeness or kindness or manners or all these are actually, they are liberated from a sense of obligation to serve, to maintain the hegemony of the subject I mentioned. So the traditional subject, right? Mm-hmm. So manners become something very different if they don't serve anymore to preserve hierarchies of who is a good human, who is a worthy human. So we are sitting in an art gallery. So a similar deconstruction happened within art world in the context of who is an artist. So Linda Nochlin in 1971 asks this question, why were there not famous women artists? And then she responds, because the notion of artist was created only to fit a man. So then if we change the notion of artists, then we'll find out that there were so many women who were very good at arts, but they were not recognized, they were not visible, they were not this and that. So I believe what you say, I believe that a useful addition to what you describe as good manners, for instance, or caring, is actually that they don't serve anymore to maintain a hierarchy of exceptionalist human who is all-powerful, who is fully capable. We are not fully capable. Many of us have disability or illnesses that we don't show. Many of us have disabilities that are actually showing pretty much, and that make some parts of life difficult. And then, so if we dismantle this subjectivity, and if we say, okay, all very different humans, are good subjects. It's not only the strong. I believe that somehow, I think that what I was just saying somehow answers to your question in a way. It's like, decency doesn't have to be only a version of subscribing to the hegemony of white privileged masculinity. Decency can be something different. Good manners can be something different. They can be an effort to be together regardless of differences, or even praising the differences that we might have, all of us. And yeah, so I would add this to your answer, because I think that like that it becomes a little bit maybe more synthetic or easier to apply. I was also thinking, responding to the first person, I was also thinking of the bikers' paths in Gdańsk and in the Tri City, in Gdańsk, Sopot and Gdynia. It so happens that 25 years ago I joined the team of Citizens Council, willing to help to the city council to build a better bikers paths. And that team was an extravaganza. Nobody had that kind of team at the time. And it meant that users of bikes wanted to help the city hall to build better bikers paths. And we did. So at first they just wanted to silence us with cookies. and they were absolutely not listening in the city hall. But then with time, they learned that they get actually better electoral results if they support bikers. So they started to really collaborate, and this team was growing, and it had bikers of different professions, but also including architects, landscape planners, urbanists, so all kinds of people used bikes, and they wanted to have good trajectories. So if you go to Gdańsk, and or if you hear about Gdańsk being the best city for, or three cities actually, for bicycles, this is where it came from. It came from the ability of resigning from the city hall, of resigning from this hegemonic position, which imposed certain, you know, ways of organizing the bikers' transport. And they were like slowly opening to the users and inhabitants. Another part of my answer to your super important question is also to think about permarchitecture and basically permaculture. So also efforts to find materials within a perimeter, which would reduce the transport, the routes that are incredibly dangerous from ecological point of view, but also which might disturb the kind of organic way of building the infrastructure, the buildings, the pathways, etc. So, and there is a beautiful book, Bernadette, Where Are You? Also a movie, Bernadette, Where Are You? Which speaks precisely of a brilliant woman architect who is a perm architect. So, for instance, when she gets to transform a factory of glass, she builds a lot of luxfers, you know, the walls using pieces of glass, because she finds many of them. Mm. So the factory, when they closed, they just left a lot of glass elements in it. So she builds stuff with this. So you get a fantastic building full of glass just because it was there and other materials were not. And this is a very pop cultural narrative. The movie was playing in the cinemas, you know, all over, and the book is a very pop book. However, it presents a brilliant woman. So it is one of the not many situations when you see a woman who is a professional, not a wife of a professional, but a professional who does something interesting, who seems to be crazy, but is not in the end, et cetera, et cetera. So I won't spoil it further, but it's also mother-daughter relation. And those projects in the movie, especially, they are shown and they are really amazing.
The question which you spoke about in the designing for the bike paths of the human diversity that's necessary to realize large-scale projects, which in this case is kind of not so large scale. Mm. It's really about bringing something in and through a community. The diversity of voices that are required for a project like that to actually work, I think point to the fact that diversity is actually a core value, mm-hmm. as well, that diversity may also be one of the little virtues. And I can say, certainly from my own experience, over the last 4 or 5 years, I've been closely involved with a charity that, when I first became part of it, the all of the board were all or mostly white men of a certain age. And they would come together for their meetings and fight. Every board meeting would just be, you know, fighting. And over the last 4 or 5 years, we've diversified the board. So it's not just making sure that there's an even balance of gender, but we have young people and old people. We have very experienced people and people who are just coming in. We've got people from different continents, people from different ethnic backgrounds. And now, when people come into the room, they're absolutely eager to talk to each other and to learn from one another and to do things. So the momentum that we've been able to put together as an organization speaks to the fact that actually human diversity is as healthy for human ecologies as biodiversity is healthy for natural ecologies. So the more we strive for biodiversity, at the same time, we've also got to strive for human diversity. So it means not just the voice of the other, but the voice of every other sector of the everyday that can be included in decision-making processes and institution-building processes. And actually, like, kind of being a part of the board of a charity doesn't sound like a very queer thing to do, but actually the queer voice there is incredibly important, and a kind of queer sensibility is very, very helpful for rethinking about the way that our institutions work and are run and what makes them healthy.
I actually think that it's very interesting that now we are not afraid to say something like queering the institutions or queer institutions, while 10, 20 years ago it would be, I think, not so well seen as the dominant really strand within queer theory was precisely so anti-normative that even discussing the, you know, queering of institutions was like, you don't want to do that. And then suddenly right now we're thinking okay, how to diversify, let's say, the museums, council or team in such a way that the collection can reflect upon the diversity of society, not only male and female artists, but more broadly, non-binary people, people from minorities of whatever kind, ethnic, sexual, all different groups. And then you have to have a different council, right? And different decision making. So this is kind of interesting because on one hand, it's queering and it's really changing something. On the other hand, it is normalizing because being a part, let's say, of a collective of the hand is already pretty normalizing situation. And yet it might not serve the purpose of normativity understood as like reducing the difference. I would like to thank you, basically, Tim, and thank you all of you and the translators for your heavy work. I would like to thank also to the Zachęta team and specifically to Zbyszek, to Monika Weichert, to Maria Brewińska also for having us here because it was quite a ad hoc invitation, and to Prince Galam for making the exhibition and being here, and again to all of you. So thank you, team, thank you very, very much, and thank you all.
Thank you, Eva. Thank you.
And the artists are gonna make a performance at 4 o'clock, so if you want to, you can search for them. Probably at the entrance there is gonna be some more information about it, but it's gonna happen in 20 minutes. Thank you so much.